Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to The Game Changers. I'm Sue Anstis, and this is the podcast where you'll hear from trailblazing women in sport. A big thank you to Barclays for supporting this series of The Game Changers, which features fearless women in football and reinforces their incredible support for the beautiful game. I'm so excited to introduce my guest today. It's Julie Welch, Fleet Street's first female sports reporter. You can imagine some of the stories Julie shared about what sports reporting was like for a young woman back in the 70s. Having won the Daily Telegraph magazine's inaugural Young Writer of the Year Awards back in 1969, Julie went on to become an award-winning sports writer for The Observer. Along with her work in football, Julie has also written plays, books, and a film, Those Glory, Glory Days, about her childhood passion for Spurs. So, when did Julie first decide she wanted to become a journalist?
What sparked me first off was when I was at school, well, just off Fleet Street, the City of London School for Girls, where I was for 2 years, was in Carmelite Street, which of course is in the same road as the Daily Mail was then. And I mean, this is in prehistory. It was, 1959, 1960, 1961. We were so close to Fleet Street. You could hear the newspaper lorries. You could see them going past. You could feel the presses roll. And I just knew then, this is such an exciting environment. And you know, I'd always been passionate about newspapers. Well, not always, since I was about sort of 5, 6, 7 years old. And I just thought, you know, this is where I'm going to end up. I just know.
And was sport a passion for you growing up?
Oh, yes. The only sport you could sort of get on television back then was, well, not only, but it was mainly horse racing, wall to wall, because my father liked to have a little bet. And I used to sit with him and follow the horses. And that sort of started off my curiosity about horses, horse racing. I read all about it in the newspapers. My father would sort of have the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail spread out on the breakfast table and sort of mark off his little bets for the day. I just decided, you know, I'm going to mug up everything I know about horse racing so I can talk to my dad, because he was this sort of quite important figure locally and in business, and I didn't get much time with him. So I thought, right, well, if I'm an expert on horse racing, I'll get to know, you know, I'll be able to talk to him. And after that, my interest kind of widened, because I was reading all about the horses in the papers. And then I started reading all about the football in the papers. And it so happened that when I was at the City of London School, I became best friends with 3 other girls in my year who were all Spurs family supporters. And so, of course, I got in with them and became passionate about Spurs. And it so happened that in 1960 to 1961, Spurs, which was by then my team, achieved the great feat of winning the league title and the FA Cup in 1 year, which had never before been done. I mean, it was just wondrous. You know, I thought, life is going to be like this all the time. You know, I'm going to always pick the winner. And of course, I had a crush on Danny Blanchflower, the Spurs captain, as well. You know, I've sort of followed his playing life. And then he also started working as a journalist on the Sunday Express. He wasn't like other footballers. You know, he was quite learned, and he wrote books, which was really exciting because, of course, everybody thought footballers were thickos. But here was this amazing man who had lifted the FA Cup and wrote for the Sunday Express. To go forward several years, when I first started working as a football reporter, we're now in 1973. The fourth match I ever covered was at Crystal Palace. And of course, I wasn't an expert reporter by any means by then. It was only my fourth go at it. I didn't see that Danny was in the press box. And after the match, I was sort of standing outside trying to get a taxi, and it was absolutely impossible. And suddenly this Mercedes drew up, and this Northern Irish voice, which I won't do the accent because I'm hopeless at that. This Northern Irish voice said, "Would you like a lift?" And I looked in, and it was Danny Blanchflower. He'd seen me in the press box. And he gave me a lift all the way back to Fleet Street, and we chatted, and it was absolutely just, you know, like a dream. It was surreal. And again, moving forward another, well, few years, by that time I'd also started a career writing scripts, plays, films, things like that. And I went to see David Putnam because he wanted me to write something for a series. He was commissioning a series of films about first love. Went to see him, these lovely offices in a muse in Kensington. And we had this long chat, and I came up with all these ideas, and he obviously was completely underwhelmed with all of them. And just as a sort of passing shot, as I got up to go, he said, "Well, you know, tell me about the first match you reported." So I said, "Well, you know, this wasn't the first match, but it was pretty close to it. Blah, 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 in the press box, taxi, Danny Blanchflower, lift back to Fleet Street." And he just said, "Well, there's your intro." So out of that came the film that I wrote about supporting Spurs when I was a child, Those Glory, Glory Days.
And it's still on Amazon Prime. We watched it last week.
It tends to get put on, you know, when there's they need a sports film and they haven't got anything else handy. And of course, I've seen it so many times now. I don't really watch it anymore because I know how it turns out. But yes, it's lovely that people still see That's it. True. And I get lots of sort of comments from younger women and girls who said, "Yes, that was my story too."
Fantastic. And to take you back a little bit to a previous book as well. So you wrote Too Marvellous for Words, depicting your time at an all-girls boarding school in Suffolk. And I think the prospectus of the school at the time said their role was to equip you to play a useful part in life. So how did the school shape your approach to life, do you think?
Well, the interesting thing is that if ever I meet a woman who went to a boarding school around the late 60s, early 70s. And I think, you know what it's like, the terrible food, the cold dormitories, the standing around on hockey pitches while the northeast wind blasts its way up your divided skirt. You know about all the sort of really grim uniform and the mad spinster teachers who, poor women, you know, just banged up in these sort of nunneries for years on end. At least we girls were able to get out at the end, but these poor women were stuck there because, of course, back then there were so few opportunities for women. Any woman who was sort of had any brains or anything like that or ambition, what could she do? I mean, you know, that you were given a choice. You could go into nursing, you could go into teaching. That's about all you could do, really. You could be a games captain, something like that. So I think my generation was the first who actually began to step out of the mold and say, you know, we can do something else. We're going to. It was a time of sort of women's lib, student rebellions. You know, for the first time, I think we had the more freedom of choice, not absolute freedom of choice by any means. But, you know, if you really, really, really wanted to do something and you found a man who was prepared to let you do it, then you could sort of step up the ladder.
And what were your ambitions as you left school?
Well, I wanted to be a writer, actually, rather than a journalist. I wrote something which won a writing award, the Telegraph Young Writer of the Year, and I was offered a job with the Telegraph. By this time, I was nearly 21. But unfortunately, I had an unplanned pregnancy. So instead of working for the Telegraph, I was married with a young baby. Again, things were quite difficult because having sort of risen to the heights where I'd been a prize-winning writer, I was now, you know, with severe postnatal depression, sort of slopping around the house in a dressing gown. And my mum eventually pushed me into going to secretarial college. And that was another thing that, you know, women were allowed to be back then. So I did my shorthand and typing, and I saw a job advertised, and it was for a secretary to the Observer sports department. The Observer was my paper because I was passionately interested in what Hugh McIlvany, their star sports writer, wrote. And they had all these other brilliant sports writers. And I thought, the Observer, sport, you know, I can, even if I don't do anything else in life, I can just sit there and, you know, talk about football and horse racing all day. You know, it'll be absolute bliss. So I applied for the job. It was, again, oh, it was just heavenly. I sort of wore these sort of stupid kind of early 1970s clogs, you know, the Bieber clogs. Anybody of my generation who can remember Bieber clogs will know what they're like. You know, they were about 4 inches high, made cork soles, and you know, you had to be very careful not to fall off them. And, you know, I was in a mini dress and everything. And I turned up at the Observer and met the sports editor, who didn't look at all like a sports editor. He sort of looked as though he'd been kitted up by Oxfam, actually. You know, his trousers were kind of tied up with pyjama cord or something like that, and you know, his tie was hanging around his neck, and he had this sort of grotty old jacket on. Instead of asking me about my shorthand and typing speeds, he said, right, it's opening time, let's go down to the pub. So I got my job interview in the pub, and I got the job. And that was it. That's me. That's the rest of my life sorted out, really, because all my life stemmed from that mad interview with the wonderful Clifford Makins, God rest his soul. It was just a fantastic ride.
And how do you transition then from that secretarial role into a journalistic position?
Well, if you're in a stimulating environment, you can't help it. However sort of low and down you feel, I think, well, this was true for me. Just being there made me start writing again, because while I'd had this sort of depression, I'd been unable to write. I just couldn't. And just suddenly, with all these sort of wonderful characters around me, I just thought, yes, I can do it. And I just started writing short stories, got one or two published in Honey magazine. Again, something for my generation that they'll remember. That was great. And I had something published in a literary magazine, because of course the Observer was incredibly highbrow, and while they were completely underwhelmed with my having stories published in Honey, they were so impressed that I had a story published in a literary magazine. And it was at that moment that the new sports editor said, well, we know you like football very much, we know you like sport, why don't you try writing something for us? So I toddled off and I wrote something for them. And that was the summer of 1973. And I get, again, just absolute bliss, you know, to see your first byline in a paper. It's just so exciting. I've still got the page proof. I took it home with me, still a bit damp from where it came off, the, you know, the presses or whatever it is. And it's sort of all crisp and yellowing and old now. But there it is. My name in the paper, Julie Welch. Oh, I could never beat that feeling, honestly.
And what was it about writing about football, do you think, that appealed to you so much in particular?
Oh, where do I start? It's so difficult, isn't it? Because of course, anybody who found out back then what I did said, well, that's a very unusual job for a woman, isn't it? And I thought, is it? You know, I'd loved football. I loved it since I fell in love with Danny Blanchflower. I was so interested in it because, you know, it had everything, really. It was kind of the national obsession already. To be honest, it had all these gorgeous blokes playing football. I mean, you know, I can't lie. That was a huge part of the attraction. I loved the game. You know, it was, I could understand the game. I cannot understand cricket or rugby at all. I mean, it just doesn't sort of touch my heart at all, let alone, you know, my head. But football, it's that soap opera kind of aspect of football as well. I mean, if you support Spurs, which I do, you're always following a soap opera. I write something called The Biography of Tottenham Hotspur, which is, you know, sold by Spurs. And I have to update it every 2 or 3 years because there's always a new turn of events in the soap opera. I mean, all those things and more are the appeal of writing about football. But there were other things as well once I got to be a football reporter. Just the excitement of being in the press box. There were disadvantages towards being in the press box because, you know, not all the men in the press box actually wanted a woman in there. But just, you know, the sheer excitement of watching the match, of writing your thoughts down. But it was just the whole thing, you know, just the excitement of writing your words, phoning the copy taker, running to catch your train after the match, just getting the right words for a match, summing up a match. It's an excitement which I still miss, although I don't think actually I could act. I don't think I'm physically capable of doing it anymore. You know, it was so stressful, but it was a sort of wonderful stress.
And the book, you do in the book relay that fantastic experience, which is also in the film too, isn't it? That first experience of you in the press box the first time. So how did the wider media react to having a woman in such a male environment in those early years?
Looking back, I sort of feel quite a bit of sympathy for the men because it was their cosy all-male club. And suddenly there was this sort of quite conceited Dolly Bird type swanning in. And some of them resented it. Some of them obviously felt uncomfortable but were too nice to say anything. One was absolutely terrifying. He just used to sort of sit behind me and sort of say what rubbish it was having a woman there and all that sort of stuff. And I used to find him very frightening. I mean, he looked like the child catcher anyway. But I got to a point in the first season or so when I thought, oh dear, I just can't do this any longer. You know, I sort of envied the men because they'd just bowl in and, you know, start chatting and drinking and doing, you know, their bloke stuff. And I just felt like, you know, the being from outer space. This sort of attitude amongst only some of the men, not all of them, did go on for a long time, long after I wasn't the only woman in the press box. I mean, Sue Mott started writing for the Sunday Times, and we had Vicky Orvis. The late Vicky Orvis, a wonderful person. Alison Rudd, Louise Taylor, Amy Lawrence. I mean, so many. There's so many, I'm sort of forgetting them. But we all kind of had to pass through this barrier of this awful man. I mean, if you go on social media, there is still a huge resistance in some male circles to women actually invading what they regard as their sport. But normally now it's just really inadequate kind of men who, you know, that's all they can do. All the only thing in life for them is to sort of sit there in their basements at their keyboards saying, you know, telling women like me to go back into the kitchen or to make them a sandwich. And so there's a sort of pathos there and you don't take much notice of it. But, you know, it is still difficult for women in working in the football industry. You have a wonderful, wonderful pundit now, Alex Scott, who is absolutely mustard. She is brilliant. You know, she's done her homework, she's researched, she's played the game at the highest level. She knows her stuff. And she is streets ahead of quite a lot of these sort of pensioned off male players who come on. And even she sort of gets a lot of criticism from certain circles again.
How did you cope with that personally? So you talk about that gentleman that we're not going to name, but what made you stick at it and not just throw the towel in and think this is not a pleasant experience to come to each week?
Well, partly it's bloody-mindedness, isn't it? Most women who have to sort of carve a path probably have the same quality, especially as, you know, somebody like me. I just thought, well, to hell with you. I'm going to do this. You know, I've got a child to support. I've got a mortgage. This is my living. This is what I do. Get over it. But it was very difficult. There were times when I felt very lonely and unhappy. I hope it is easier now for young women in the football industry because, you know, it's such a great thing to do and not to have to work with sort of general feeling around you of I shouldn't be here, you know, I'm not liked. That was awful. And the fact that I think men's attitudes have changed, and there were quite a few kind men who I've named in the book who were supportive. People like them actually enabled me to carry on. But it was bloody-mindedness. It really was. You know, I'm not going to let them defeat me.
And you were the girl in the press box for 13 years, and you've been described as a reluctant trailblazer. And I think you've mentioned all those amazing other women that were also coming through at the time. But how do you feel at the time about breaking that new ground for women in that way? Well, did it bring more pressure in terms of there being additional scrutiny on you as a female?
Well, when I did my first match report, I can remember the huge feeling of relief when it actually went into the paper, because I thought, well, I haven't let other women down. The blokes won't be able to say, oh, I'll see what happens when you send a girl to report a match. So, yes, there was that. I felt a huge, huge responsibility that while I was the only one, it sounds a bit self-pitying, but it did feel kind of like a burden in that I did not want to make a bad job of it. But, I mean, a lot of male reporters can feel the same, you know, just because they don't want to do a bad job.
Would you have called yourself a feminist at the time? I know the terms almost changed in terms of how people accept it and describe themselves now. Did you feel you were a feminist at the time?
It's a difficult issue, that, because I never called myself a feminist, because partly out of self-preservation, because I worked with so many men. Yeah, my working life, you know, everybody else had a willy, basically. To sort of say, oh, I'm a feminist, would not have been a good move. I mean, I have always supported equal rights for women. I do think women tend to be slightly different in their goals because we have the complication of being women. But yes, while not calling myself a feminist, I still am, probably, basically.
What do you think it is that made you such a great football writer? Do you think you wrote interviews and reports differently to your male colleagues?
That's an interesting question. I think if my reports were rather different, there were several reasons. One was that I wasn't a trained journalist. I hadn't done the hard yards on the local papers. So, you know, I was a complete amateur. The first football match I reported was actually the first live report I'd ever done. So there was that. I tried to imitate my colleague Arthur Hopcraft, who went on to be a very good playwright. He wrote the script for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and various things like that. I think also the difference might have been that I'm a writer rather than a journalist, in that way that actual writing was my first love rather than actual journalism. And also I think, I don't know, I just it was the kind of, if you are a woman watching men at play, men in captivity, you kind of see the it's quite entertaining, isn't it? I mean, men quite regularly make fun of women. They don't think anything of it. But if you poke a little gentle fun at men, they are cut to the quick. I think that was probably the difference. And I probably am, you know, a funny writer rather than a pompous, serious writer. Can't help it. It's just how I am.
And how did the players and managers treat you?
Oh, they were fabulous. There were one or two who kind of got the wrong idea. I mean, there were one or two who sort of clammed up at the sight of this rather posh young lady, you know, kind of turning up to interview them rather than a beery bloke stinking of bad aftershave and cigarettes, but there were one or two who were sort of, you know, virtually unzipping their flies. But on the whole, they were just super, you know. I discussed the issue in the book, to be serious for a bit. I was, today I'd know what it was. I was assaulted by one manager in front of the rest of the journalists. And nobody said a word. And it was just it was a horrible, embarrassing incident, which, you know, it would never happen today. So there was that as well. I mean, attitudes then were entirely different. And as I say, I have discussed this in the Fleet Street Girls, and some of the other people that I spoke to in the book also had the same issues. But what did you do? I mean, you know, you just get over it. It was just, you know, a job hazard, really, like working with chemicals.
An analogy. We hear a lot about the sort of hard drinking culture. You've alluded slightly to that with your interview in the pub at the time. Most of the business of the day was done in the pub. I guess, is that something you experienced much, though? How did you get anything done, would be my question.
Oh, not at all. I spent a lot of years in Fleet Street being at least mildly drunk and sometimes absolutely out of my mind drunk. I mean, it was a drinking culture. I had a very strong head, thank heavens. But I mean, you know, the reckless way that we all kind of treated our health and our bodies, you know, on a match day, I could easily get through two packets of cigarettes. And I think once I got through three packets of cigarettes. You know, you'd get back from your story and you'd all go down the pub and, you know, I'd have enormous amounts of vodka or rum and coke. And then, this is shameful, then I would actually get in my car and drive home. I mean, it was a reckless life. I'm not sure how I came to be so healthy today. Honestly, a lot of the men that I worked with, who I adored and loved, they're gone, just gone. You know, they killed by cigarettes and alcohol. I mean, my lovely first sports editor, Clifford Makins, the one who interviewed me in the pub, he was an alcoholic. There were a lot of alcoholics in Fleet Street. I mean, I was very lucky because I stopped the true Fleet Street life when I remarried and had a couple more children. And although I was still reporting, I wasn't actually sort of hanging out in the pub anymore. So I wasn't as drunk as I was. It is a rare thing now for me to drink a glass of wine even. And I think it's because my life is much less stressful. Also, when I got into my late 40s, I took up running, another great love of mine. You know, if you have a target like a marathon, it fills the void in a way. I mean, I feel sorry for a lot of men that I knew then who, once they retired, they had nothing else. Whereas I was, as I said, so lucky to find something else fulfilling and something I could write about as well. And in fact, another really fun book that I wrote about 10 years ago was about a nonstop 100-mile walk. You had 48 hours to get out alive. So I wrote about that and I did it. And I did it in 38 and a half hours. And it was just wonderful to do it. You make so many friends when you're doing these long distance events, you know, because you're all absolutely poleaxed with exhaustion and feeling really morose, as you know, by about mile 70 you just want to die, and you sort of shuffle along talking rubbish and hallucinating.
Going back to your, I guess, leaving Fleet Street, so as you did, what do you feel you missed most? And clearly, as you say, you had other things to move on to, but was it hard to return to almost like a normal life, having been in such an exciting career at the sort of heart of national media?
I found it awful at first. In a way, you know, it was my heart's desire to get married, because I'd been divorced and I'd been a single parent, and to get married again and to have two more children, because I think, you know, if a woman wants children, she has a set number of children she must have. And so I had my three, which is what I wanted.
I'm three too.
Exactly. Was it the set number?
Yeah, absolutely.
but just we lived in a rather posh street with a lot of posh couples who the women were kind of like me. They'd left sort of sizzling careers to do womaning. And we were all as miserable as sin, you know, and some were really sort of down in the mouth and bitchy about it. And others, you know, kind of turned into super mother and you know, put all their efforts in, and ability and brains into sort of having the best child in the street. And I just didn't know how to talk to these people because, of course, I speak the language of Fleet Street. I still do. I'm terribly sweary. I mean, I've got this notice actually in front of my desk. Do not swear. Because otherwise, you know, I would have to remind myself not to swear at you or, you know, say a rude word because I still speak Fleet Street. And, you know, everything suddenly got terribly polite. And I just felt it took me so long to get used to it. And in fact, I still don't think I'm used to it. Most of the women I knew then, I just have fallen out of touch with because I just couldn't stand it any longer.
And did you regret leaving the profession when you did? Might you have gone on to become an editor of a newspaper? Was that ever something you would have wanted to pursue?
I think that I'd reached the ceiling for me in sport because I was a woman. We now have Alison Kirvin, who is a sports editor of the Mail on Sunday, who is totally brilliant and wonderful. But back then, it was never going to happen. And also, I don't think I'd have been good on the sort of editorial desk side just because I'm not organised and not disciplined. I'd never have coped with budgets or anything like that. You have to have a much better executive function than I ever had. I mean, I just rely on my husband even now telling me what to do next because I don't know whether it's something to do with being very much the youngest child in a family. I mean, I had an older sister, 10 years older, but then, you know, but my parents were sort of old parents when they had me. I just used to sort of sit there and wait for them to tell me what to do and organise things for me. Sheer laziness, but it stuck. Even now, I really have to make myself sort of do things because it's so much easier just to let it all kind of wash around you.
But you have gone on to do some amazing things in terms of being a playwright and screenwriter and author. It'd be lovely to know a little bit more about, I guess, about that success and that progress that you made almost full circle where you wanted to be a writer in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Well, I lost a lot of confidence after I left Fleet Street. I don't think I had a lot of confidence anyway, strangely enough. In the first place, I've always, you know, been absolutely delightfully surprised when anybody likes anything I've written, for instance, because I think I'm so used to being told I'm weird and unusual. And I have been most of my life simply because, you know, of my love of football. I went through a spell where I didn't do anything very much. You know, I was in terms of writing stuff. And I did start writing things and they never worked out. It was kind of gradual. I was lucky in the mid-90s. Firstly, I was still sort of writing journalism as a freelance. And a very nice young radio producer asked me to work for him doing a little radio programme about sport. And that was 2 years of absolute happiness. It was wonderful. But I think It wasn't really till I started running and sort of exercising and doing all that stuff and turning 50 and going through the menopause. And I went mad for about 2 years with the menopause, I think. I was terribly weepy. And then suddenly I snapped into energy again and I started just, you know, doing what I was kind of meant to do in the first place. I just started writing all these books. Certainly from about the time I was 55 onwards, it's just kind of just been great. I think if I can inspire any woman who's younger than me, who might think, well, you know, I'm past it now. You're not past it. You know, the best is yet to come. My 60s, which I've only just lived through, but probably the best decade of my life in many ways in terms of achieving things, because I've just got all my stuff together.
I love that. I'm 55 this year, so that's marvellous. I'm so excited. So I guess just to finally, as we move forward, what's next for you now? That amazing last decade, but what are your plans moving forward now?
On my 70th birthday, I had a chat to my friend Jennifer Selway, who's actually in the Fleet Street Girls and has been, you know, a really good mate of mine since we were colleagues on The Observer. And she's a little bit younger than me. And I said, well, this is what I'm going to do now. I'm turning 70 and I'm going to make a sort of list of the next 10 years, you know, because hopefully over the next 10 years, I won't go gaga. I won't have anything badly wrong with me. So I'm going to write X number of books, blah, blah, blah. So this is what's going on for me now. I'm writing a novel. I'm updating my life's work, the biography of Tottenham Hotspur at the moment. I've got a couple of ideas for non-fiction books. I'm doing a bit more InVision stuff, TV, radio again, which is nice. I mean, it's terribly nice that somebody will actually kind of want to employ an old bag. I mean, it just, everything goes on. It, in spite of lockdown and all the difficulties and all the sort of obstacles, I feel really great about life at the moment. I think you have to just go with it, you know, be positive if you can. Things are difficult. And I will share one thing. I live with two men, my husband, who is in his 80s, and one of my sons, who has a flat at the top of our house, and he's working from home because he's a lawyer. But both have been really miserable, whereas I haven't so much. And I think my theory, that is that women are better at coping with this kind of thing, because certainly for my generation, we're so used to having to overcome obstacles and, you know, being thwarted, you know, because that's what happens to women in the workplace. So something like this comes our way, you know, we're already wired to manage it, to make the best of what we can and be positive and do what we can and try and get around it the best way we can. So that's my theory.
And just finally, some advice. What advice would you give to women? You mentioned the amazing Alex Scott and others, but women come into sports media today. Are there any gems of advice you'd like to impart, do you think, from your career?
I mean, it's hard to get a job in sport anyway because it's so popular. Journalism is a difficult world now. But if you like writing, if you love sport, if you adore it, then you just got to go for it. You have to like men, and I think men have to like you. It's no use being hostile to men, because they, you know, basically they're out there doing the best they can as well. But if you like men, if they like you, and if you love sport, and preferably if you know you can write the pants off them as well, then you know you've just got to go for it, haven't you? You've just got to do it.
A big thank you to Julie for talking so openly about her life and career. She's certainly inspired me to keep achieving in the next decade. Thanks also to Barclays for their kind support of the Game Changers, and also to Sam Walker from What Goes On Media, who does a great job as executive producer of the podcast. Head over to fearlesswomen.co.uk for more information about the 58 incredible Game Changers featured in this and previous series. You can also listen to them from the website, or you'll find us in all the usual podcast places, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Previous trailblazing guests include the likes of Jess Ennis-Hill, Judy Murray, Tanigwe Thompson, Catherine Granger, and Tracy Edwards, so please do have a listen. Next week, I'm talking to Jess Fishlock, a professional footballer who's played in 9 different countries. Wales' most capped player and a global role model for the LGBTQ+ community, Jess is certainly a woman who isn't afraid to stand up and speak her mind.
We're not stupid. We understand that saying that we want to be paid $250,000 a week is just not real. Like, it's not. But we also have enough respect for ourselves that we're saying everything else, though, should be the same.
The Game Changers. Fearless Women in Sport.